This is an interview with Mr. Alonzo Waters of Medina, New York. The interview is being conducted by Arden McAllister on February 14th, 1978.
I'll say I was born in at Oak Orchard on the Ridge. 1893. Attended the public school there, the little country school there, until, I've forgotten just what age, but one of Professor John Filer came to Knowlesville. Let's see what we got there now. Then I attended the Knowlesville Union School, it was at the time. And so I was graduated from the elementary school there and went to work that summer for a chap by the name of Woods, who had a nursery in the Knowlesville vicinity, and really had no encouragement and had no particular thought of continuing my education. But finally along in, I think about October of 1908, I did enroll in Medina High School and came here and was graduated in 1912 from the school here. During the time I entered somewhat into both the athletic and cultural activities of the school. I played football, baseball, and on the debating team, and so on and so forth. But during the years that I was at Medina, we had a principal of the school who was a graduate of Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and he encouraged four of us. There were four of us. There was Harry Freeman, who later became quite active in city management work in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He was a city manager there, and finally back became city manager of Buffalo before he died. And a James Campana, who was an attorney in Buffalo, came back to Buffalo as an attorney there. And a fellow named Robert Colburn, who afterwards became identified with the Procter & Gamble Company in Cincinnati, Ohio, and myself. But I only attended 1 year. And after that, I engaged in the life insurance business here in Medina. I was encouraged by a man by the name of Colburn, who was then head of the history department the university. Miami University.
And I
engaged in that business until World War I, when I entered the service there in 1917 and continued through. I was wounded and returned to Medina in the fall of 1918.
I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. Were you recruited through the armory here?
No. I was drafted. I was under draft.
I see. And did you, when you left for the service, was there a whole contingent that left?
Yes. I went from Medina to Fort Dix, and I was only in Fort Dix 6 weeks. Before I went overseas, had no training at all. I was a part of the 108th Field Artillery, which regiment was practically completed. They only needed a few, more to fill up the regiment, and I was one of them. So I went in. In the spring, I think it was in April, and I was overseas in June.
Mm-hmm. Would that have been 1918?
1918,
yeah.
Yes. That was the year the war ended, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah,
that was the year. 1918. And we, after landing in Liverpool, we went immediately to a camp in France, and our first engagement was the Buchan. And after that, I was in November. Well, in November, I was wounded. And I went from one camp to another. This was after the war was the war was over on the 11th of 1918.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, they were kept evacuating these medical centers, medical camps.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I was in 7 before I finally landed back here in February of 1919. That's what it was, February 1919.
After I did, they returned.
I went then with the Journal Register.
I see. Can I ask you a little bit more about that? When you left Medina here to go in the service, how did you get to Fort Dix? Did you go down to the railroad?
Yes, we.
Was there any kind of a ceremony or anything with group of?
You see, each county at that time was required to send a certain amount of draftees. So
yeah.
I went to Albion.
Oh, I see.
And from Albion, I think there were 7 or 8 of us.
Oh, yeah.
John Selevich, I don't know if you remember John Selevich, died here weeks or months ago.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of them.
From Medina.
Oscar Stanton and, a fellow by the name of Hoy out on the Ridge Road. I can't recall the others, but there was half a dozen of us who left Albion. That went directly to Dix.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. We were all sent, put into Battery E of the 108th, 308th, it was the Battery E 308th Field Artillery.
I see.
108th Division.
Oh, yeah. Well, did you have a time there when you were motorcycle?
No, I don't know where you got that. I don't recall ever owning a motorcycle. No, I think I.
I see.
No, I never had any experience with motorcycles.
Oh, I don't know where I got that.
I don't know where that came from. No.
Yeah, no. You were in a field artillery.
Yes, I was in the field artillery.
Yeah.
Yes, I was a gunner on a French 75.
Mm-hmm.
During the
war. Were you involved in any of the big battles there?
Well, we were in the Meuse-Argonne.
That
was the
sector.
And we were in those various engagements, which was a major one at the time.
Sure. Right.
Yeah. You see, we went actively. We went into training in camp. We didn't get up until. Up to the front until about July, and following September, why I was incapacitated.
Yeah, I see.
I was hitting my shoulder and a piece of gas.
Oh,
thing up there.
That was awarded to you.
Well, that shows I was wounded.
Yeah,
that's the Purple Heart. That's the goes with the Purple Heart.
That goes with it.
So I came back then down to a camp near New York, and I had a dickens of a time getting out of the Army.
Oh, really?
I had more trouble getting out than I did getting in, because of the fact that we came back as casuals, you see, as a casual company, and I don't know the exact number, but we'll say 126. Men who had been were not assigned to the original units, but were from New York State, came back as a casual unit, and 126 came back, And we came back at Camp Mills. I remember Camp Mills in New York. And we were so near New York that about 50 of them lived there. They just went home.
Oh.
So when we finally were enrolled, our company had shrunk that many.
I see.
So what they did was to take them alphabetically. Mm-hmm. And I was the W's.
Oh, boy.
So I was out nowhere. I wasn't attached to anybody.
Oh, dear.
So I got a job in the office. And I got my, I attached myself to a company and finally got out.
Oh, gee. Yeah, that works to disadvantage a lot of times, doesn't it, be at the end of the alphabet?
That's right, that's right. I did that. Then I came home. And I had, then I went with the Journal. I had, had some experience with the Journal while I was in school.
Oh.
Be corresponding to school, to the paper, and so on and so forth. And I was always had a little flair for that type of work, so I went with them in 1919.
Who owned it then, Lon?
Mr. Hinchey, W. John Hinchey. Oh. Well, there were three owners. W. John Hinchey and Charles N. Hood, you'll probably know, and Milton Whedon, who was an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Three of them owned it at that time. Mm-hmm. And then that was in the spring of 1919, and in the fall of 1919, Mr. Hinchey and myself bought the Medina Register, which was owned and operated by
Mr. Bowen.
We moved the plant from East Center Street. It was at that time, when I first went with it, it was down on East Center Street. It was in one of those buildings that belonged to a fellow named Kelly, who operated the hotel right there, the Kelly House.
Kelly House.
On East Center Street. And we moved there.
That was about where Bramer's is now in 1978.
Well, that's where the Kelly House was.
Yes.
We were across the street. There were a number of little, there were two or three saloons, the Ben Saloon and the Murphy Saloon and the Bat Laundry and the Journal was in the small building there. The Journal was organized back in 1903 by David Benson and William Baker. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Hinchey, I think in about 1907 or so, bought out the Baker interests. Mm-hmm. And so he bought the Benson interest, and then the other two were Hood and Whedon bought the other, so there were three of them there. But in 19, that fall, we bought the Medina Weekly Register, which was owned and operated by Bowen, and we moved up to where we are now, and part of the building we are now. That's just about a third of what we are now. So that's where I started my newspaper career. And from then on, identified with two or three men in the community. One was George A. Bowen, president of S.A. Cook & Company, and another was Robert H. Newell of Robert H. Newell & Company, and several others who sort of, I was much younger than they were, but I don't know, just I guess because of the fact that I had this means of exposing the community to the public through the journal, mm-hmm. They sort of fathered me, and I was identified with a lot of the earlier, with a lot of the 1920 and 1930 part of the community that is more or less interesting. I mean, it's interesting largely because of the change in the makeup of the mercantile activity in the mm-hmm. in the town. And I can recall when I first started in, there were about 8 or 9 clothiers.
Is that right?
Yeah, 6 of them on one side of the street, I remember.
Oh.
on the side, that is the northwest quadrant down there. It started in with the George Parkhurst at that time, and was in the clothing business. And Frank Howard was in the clothing business. And George Owens, and Adler Krugen Metz, and Philip Namus Sayers, and Montgomery and Rook, and Philip I. Brust. And they're all in that one section down through there.
Huh. Yeah.
And there were some others, of course, in other parts of the town. And your grocery stores, which now, of course, are confined to your supermarkets.
Yeah.
Like A&P had 3 stores at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And Medina, two on Main Street and one on East Center Street. And various others, like the Coopers and Henry McElway's and Grinnell and Possum had a grocery store at that time. And Arthur Hovey and many more grocery stores than there are now, of course. Now then Bill Franchell came along, you know, and bought the old Colony store. And the same way with the hardware stores. There were several hardware stores at that time. Hanlon Brothers, which later became owned and operated by Abner Bancroft, and Chase and Breed, which now is the Brundage Hardware Store. And
D.W. Wilson.
J.J. Morgan had a hardware store. And, that's all I can think of right now, but it shows you the change
sure.
now.
Yes.
They're more specialized and particularly limited in the, what they call the downtown section.
Yeah.
But of course, largely influenced by your supermarkets. And so, my job with the newspaper was largely advertising at that time. So, I ran up and down the street each day.
Yeah.
Getting ads.
So you got to know the community pretty well.
Well, I got to know a lot of it. And as I say, a lot of the various parts of the community, like Medina Memorial Hospital was organized. I was on the committee that organized it with Mr. Bond and Mr. Newell and so forth. And after the closing of the banks, we organized the Medina Trust Company. And
That's after the Depression.
Both banks closed. Mm-hmm. First the Union Bank, which was Thomas Robbins Bank.
Was that where Jay's is now?
That's where Jay's is now, on the corner.
Mm-hmm.
The first closed, and then soon afterwards, the Central Bank, which Watson Berry was the founder, and E. Rollin Clark was at that time. And but that closed. And
where was that bank located?
Right where the present Medina Trust Company is now.
Oh, that was
there, located there.
I see.
And we were without banks for several months. As a matter of fact, I had to go to Albion for banking.
Is that right?
And then the Medina Trust Company, we organized the Medina Trust Company, which later became a part of the Marine Midland.
Oh.
Okay. And of course, I've been during my lifetime quite largely identified with the fraternal life of the community.
Yeah,
I was quite active in the Masons. As a matter of fact, was master of the lodge at the time the temple was built, and that was largely through the activities of George Bowen and Bob Newell and myself.
Is that where it's located now?
Where it's located now. We built the building.
You built the building. Masons built that.
Yeah. Prior to that, we met in an upstairs room over what was owned by the Knights of Columbus. It was practically across from where the journal is now. An upstairs building.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1925, we completed the building, dedicated the building of the Masonic Temple, which formerly was the home of the Newell family.
The Newell family. Wasn't there a Pitts involved with that, too?
Yes, Senator Pitts lived there one time.
I see. But that was a building in the same
location. That was the same building. That is, the Newell family lived there, and Senator Pitts afterwards lived in that same building where the Masonic Temple is now.
Yeah.
That is part of it. The first part of it, most of it, of course, was in structure.
Oh, I see.
And we built that. It was dedicated in 1925. I didn't know that because I was busily engaged in some of the activities down there when Bob was born over in the Medina Hospital.
Oh, yes.
Same year, 1925.
I see.
And so I went on from there and was district deputy and held some other positions statewide of the Masons. And in the Elks at the time, I was active in the Elks. I was one of their youngest exalted rulers, I guess. I was exalted ruler back right after I came back from war. The Elks at that time were located right directly across in the Knights of Columbus Village in the same place. They were all grouped there together. And later they went down and occupied the building where the VFW have now. And then afterwards came up into the Cook Building and occupied rooms that were formerly and built for the old Alert Club, which I don't know whether you've ever heard of it or not.
It's a fire company,
It became a social club, but originally it was a fire company, the Alert of Fire Company.
Yeah.
Afterwards it became a social club.
Oh, I see.
And they sort of fell apart as the interest waned, and the Elks came up there, and they were there until their demise, I don't know how many years ago now. But I was exalted ruler there, went on to head the state association. And so I was quite active in that organization. And the American Legion, too. I held various sundry. I was one of the founders of the Clark Post.
Now, what Clark was this named after? recall that?
maybe I will before we get through.
Yeah.
I can't recall.
He was one. Was he who was he killed in the
yes,
war?
Yes. He was the first man from Medina area who lost his life in World War One. Uh-huh. And James P. Clark. Uh-huh. And the post was named after him, the James P. Clark post. Colonel, after became General Thompson, mm-hmm. was its first commander and one of the prime organizers. We organized it over in a gathering over to the State Armory. And I was the first adjutant of the Clark post. And we were quite active, then the interest waned until it had its rejuvenation following World War II. Mm-hmm. And then it became the Clark Butts post, named the combination of Clark in the First World War and Butts, who gave his life in the Second World War. I can't recall the Butts' name, mm-hmm. but it was Jerry Butts' brother, but these Butts boys around here.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, I know.
Their brother. And so it has had, that organization has had its ups and its downs. It had that building down there, which it gave up. And now I guess, I don't know, I meet occasionally or order the booth. I've had little or no direct activity with it for a long time because of the fact that I just haven't had the hoop to keep up with it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Wow. All right.
Of course, my political career the germ started back when I was young, when I became interest in community affairs. And I would say probably my first political activity, and yet it's non-political now, was I became postmaster of Medina back in 1926. Oh. The postmaster, whom I won't name now, was unfortunately caught in an embezzlement sort of a thing.
Oh. Mm.
And so Post Office Department removed him and told the local, at that time it was purely a political job.
Yes, right.
Purely political. Mm-hmm. Told the local political organization they had to name a postmaster within 3 days.
Oh.
So Judge Harcourt, who was a particularly good friend of mine, called me and asked me if I'd take it temporarily.
I see.
So I went in there and I stayed there for 9 years. I was reappointed by both Herbert Hoover and Calvin Coolidge.
Oh, yeah. There are your appointments.
Yeah, the appointments, the 4-year terms.
Yeah.
And in the 1930s, Franklin D. Roosevelt was named president, and Jim Farley, who was a very personal friend of mine through the Elks, became Postmaster General.
Yeah.
So I served about a year under the Roosevelt administration until finally Jim called me one time. I was the last Republican to hold office. He said, I guess maybe we've gone about as far as we can on this. So I resigned.
Yes.
And George Callahan took my place.
Yeah. James Farley was quite a personable man, wasn't he?
Oh, yes, he was,
Claim he had an excellent memory, could remember names all over the country.
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah. He's quite a fellow. back in 1946, I think it was, I had the bug to go to the state assembly. So I ran against the incumbent, who was Colonel John Thompson, in the primary, and was defeated. And 2 years later, I wrote to all the committeemen saying I was not a candidate. There was a general rumor that I was going to oppose them again, and I wrote to them all and said I was not a candidate. But within about 2 weeks after this letter was written, Colonel Thompson died very suddenly. And it was a year of election. So the county committee met and designated me as a candidate. And I stayed from, I first started in 1949, and I was there until 1965 was my last year.
Now you represented at that time a district
Orleans County,
County only, yes.
One of the motivations for my not was the fact that at that time the reapportionment placed Orleans County in with several other counties,
yeah,
parts of counties, which made it more of a laborious campaigning operation, and also a much wider territory to service. So that was my last year in the state assembly. While I was in the assembly, I had virtue of had the opportunity, of course, of meeting a great many of well-known people throughout the state. Now, it's most frequently that I can pick up a newspaper and read of some prominent person's death whom I well knew in the assembly. Now, you notice that picture back of you. That was my first year there, probably. There are 150 assemblymen at that time, and I don't presume there are 25 or one that I can look at there I know have passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So going back there, as I did a few times, got to be a rather a lonesome sort of
thing.
Sure,
yes.
Because the fellows that I knew had either were not interested in coming back or died or so on and so forth. But while I was in the assembly, I was assigned to several committees, and I served as chairman of education for several years. Rather a singular sort of a thing. Earl Bridges, who was a senator from this area, it was Niagara and Orleans County at the time, the senatorial district. He went to Albany at the same time I did in the Senate, and he became, before he became the leader that he was in the Senate, he was chairman of education in the Senate. So he and the chairman of education in the Senate at the same time that I was in the Assembly. So we had an opportunity of working very closely together.
Sure.
And I also, while I was in the assembly, I became interested in the migrant labor situation here, particularly in Orleans County. So I introduced a resolution asking for a joint legislative committee be appointed to make a study of the seasonal farm labor situation in the state, which passed, and I was named chairman of it. So I was chairman of the Joint Legislative Committee on Migrant Labor for a number of years, and had the opportunity of seeing a lot of legislation passed, some of which has never been too rigidly enforced, but nevertheless it's on the books. But, of course, the migrant labor situation in New York State is entirely different now from what it was then.
True.
That was before the advent of the of harvesting machinery, which has replaced a great number or replaced the need, taking away the need from migrant labor. So whether we're at one time 40 or 50,000 migrants in the state, well, that's been reduced to very few, as you know, well know here in Orleans County, they don't have too many anymore. So with a reduced number, of course, the troubles have reduced, but it was quite a job for several years.
Well, during those were black or
they were all black. We had
Puerto Rican.
We had very few Puerto Ricans in New
Mexico. At first, yes.
So they're all Southern migrants, Southern Negroes. They worked a pattern up. They'd start in Florida and move up the seaboard as the crops ripened under crew management, you see. In other words, a crew leader would organize a crew of anywhere from 50 to several hundred. Like in the colony camp, it'd be maybe 500 at one time. And
where did most of the farm labor come from prior to, this began around Second World War time, I guess, when the Southern black
before
came.
That. Well, we didn't plant the number of field crops, and we had much more local labor.
More local labor.
Local labor than we had before they came here. But back in the 30s, with the advent of the expansion of the canning companies, like H.J. Heinz and General Foods and so on, which demanded a lot of tomatoes. The tomatoes, back when I was a kid on the farm, was a very relatively small crop. As a matter of fact, commercially, I don't think anybody ever planted any. But all of a sudden, that area of agriculture exploded. And it was largely picking tomatoes that they were imported for. So they came all along in August, and they didn't. Then they stayed, and then afterwards they went into orchard work.
Right.
So mostly now they are orchard work because there's very little field labor for them to do anymore. And camps here, of course, are reduced to practically nothing from what they were at that time. I don't know if there are any organized camps in the county anymore.
Not many, I guess.
I don't know of any, as a matter of fact. It used to be the Searles camp down near Lindenville, and then, of course, the colony camp, which is now Clarkson Manor, do they call it?
Carlton.
Carlton Manor.
Yes.
That was a big camp, and there was, I don't know, 50 camps around at one time, but I don't know of really any. There probably are, but I don't know of any farm labor now. They import 200 or 300 is all. Mm-hmm. During the year, it's practically dribbled down to nothing. What they do now, supplementing it, they have day haul labor. In other words, the farmer goes to Buffalo in the morning, picks up a load of workers, and brings them here and takes them back at night. I mean, they're only just here during the daylight hours. So, my other activities in the assemblies, I say, because of tenure largely, you grow into some importance, and I had the privilege of knowing a great, great many men who later went on the political fields, Rockefeller, Governor Rockefeller, and so on and so forth. I only served under one Democratic governor, that was Abel Harriman.
Oh,
Otherwise, they were all Republicans. Tom Dewey was there when I went there, mm-hmm. and he was succeeded by Abel Ehrman, and along came Mr. Rockefeller. So,
how much contact does an assemblyman have with a governor?
Well, it all depends on his position. Now, as education is one of the major committees,
yes.
So I had quite a few personal contacts. I mean, he'd send for me, and I'd go down, and we'd talk over situations and so on and so forth. Otherwise, not too much, you know, not too much personal contact with him.
Well, that gave you some opportunities to meet some pretty important people.
Well, it did. It did. As I say, a lot of these fellows that I can look at there, like Judson Morehouse, who was quite a friend of mine, who later became, as you know, quite prominent throughout the country. State chairman, unfortunately, got into some evil ways. And there's a number of them there that went on into other state positions.
Mm-hmm.
But as I look at it now, there are very, very few of them that are still in the land of
still
the
there.
Most of them.
Yeah.
Most of them.
How did you travel back and forth?
When we started out, a fellow named Jacob Hollinger, right, his picture is right there from Middleport.
Oh.
He either one or the two of us would drive to Rochester, where we would leave our cars and take the New York Central train from there to Albany. As a matter of fact, that train, a Monday morning train, see, the assembly convenes on Monday night and then it stays in session during the week as the time might require. So that during the daytime, they men from all parts of the state assembly. So by the time we got in Rochester, we took a train out of there around noontime. In fact, the entire train was filled up with either senators or assemblymen or people who worked for them, because each one of them had his own little retinue of workers from his own county, made up practically the entire train. It was quite an experience going down and back. A lot of legislation was thrashed out on those on the train.
Yeah, sure.
On the train, we had a great opportunity to do it.
Sure.
You know.
Sure.
And then afterwards, after the thruway was built, by then I drove back and forth mostly.
Yes.
Because Waters went with me largely. And